Well, good morning to you all. Fall break or not, it's good to be with you. I always enjoy coming back to Newcastle and especially glad to share responsibilities with Chris and to have had the opportunity to enjoy Penny's piano music, which I thought was superb today, so thank you for that. So, during our vacation to southern India earlier this year, Judy and I visited a national park called Periyar Wildlife Sanctuary. And as we started off that morning, we rafted across a small river on a little makeshift raft, went through the fog to the other side, and once there, we began to hike through the sanctuary out into the park. We were accompanied by a park guide. And as we walked that trail, it occurred to me that in most safaris that we had participated in, we had always had the protection of a vehicle. But on this day, we were walking. So unless DEET was going to keep all the critters at bay, my conclusion was that since we were completely exposed, we probably were not going to see much that day, not much in the way of wildlife. Surely, the park wouldn't put us in danger. So three small groups went their separate ways, each accompanied by the guide, wandering around some paths, keeping in touch by radio. We were all in search of a herd of elephants. And after we had wandered around for, 20 or 30 minutes and seen some beautiful nature, trees, birds, insects, some not so pretty insects, we came upon the elephants. They were just hanging out over in this grove of trees, minding their own business. They were feeding. There were seven or eight adults, just magnificent creatures, and there were two babies in the group. And so we're all there oohing and aahing and trying to take pictures and wondering how close can we get, and we all tried to take our cues from the guides when suddenly one of the adults in the elephant group took exception to these uninvited guests. And one of them sounded its trumpet, and they began to charge. Now, the guides yelled for us in unison to run. And if their instructions weren't enough to convince us, the fear in their eyes was. So, imagine a dozen of us in our 50s, 60s, 70s, some of whom haven't run anywhere except to the bathroom in a decade. And we are trying to make our way off the well-cleared path now into this dense thicket of woods that really is so thick with undergrowth, you can hardly find a way through it. But off we go. One of our group fell in a hole. Another tripped over the person in the hole. Judy got tangled up in a thorn bush. I lost my cap thanks to some wayward branch that swatted me as I went by. And for those of you who wonder, faced with the moral dilemma, do I keep running out of self-preservation or do I go back and help untangle my wife? I did go back. We came out together. And so once we were out, Judy and I breathed this sigh of relief, and we laughed a little bit. It was a coping mechanism laugh, not a, boy, that was fun, let's do it again kind of laugh. The title of this message is Running with Elephants, but probably more truthfully, it's Running from Elephants. You know, small change, huge difference in the mood of the experience. My guess is the elephants couldn't stop laughing from watching us trying to run through that thicket, and they eventually just said, you know, these guys are no threat. Let's go back. So they called off the chase. We made it back. I was really glad to get to the other side of that river again, and it's made for a nice memory and a nice story. But I shared that reminiscence with you this morning as an illustration of how we can set out on a journey, whether it's the task we have to do during the day or whether it's a major life choice, or somewhere in between, but we can set out on a journey thinking that we know full well what to anticipate. And we think we know the way we will follow. We know what is required of us. or at least what has been asked of us. And in case we don't have it all just the way it ought to be, we have guides with us, guides we trust, guides who know more than we do, guides who help us when we come to those moments and we don't know which way to go. What happens when the way is blocked? What happens when the routine has to be offered? What happens when the things you thought you knew were true don't necessarily hold up to the test anymore? So in those moments where we don't know where to go, we hope those guides will assist us. It may be a park guide. It may be Google Maps. It may be your Bible. It may be your devotional practice. Somewhere, I would wager, we each get the guidance we need. There's somewhere we look. There's somewhere we trust that will give us the guidance we need so that we can accomplish our objectives. But what happens when you find yourself leaving the known trusted path, running through the thicket, and the guides you once trusted don't seem to have a better plan? If you could recall a moment like that in your life, you have a sense of the confusion or the chaos or the challenge. You understand maybe the thrill and the joy that those moments bring. But if you can imagine that, take that sensation and think about what it's like when that type of thing happens within the practice of your faith. Perhaps you have or you are experiencing that very thing. I appreciated that in the pastoral prayer, part of Chris's prayer was mentioning and asking for and hoping for the ability to be faithful. I was drawn to Psalm 50 for today, thinking around that theme, in part because I remembered the verse that in some translations, God just says, "I don't want your bull." And I go, "Boy, I know that feeling. I don't want your bull." My concern today, but really the entire psalm, I think, strengthens the message around the concern I have today, which is faithfulness. Faithfulness of the church, faithfulness of us as individuals. I mean, what constitutes faithfulness? And is its path clear to us? Do our guides direct us well? In a world that seems to be begging for some moral guidance, for some spiritual grounding, does our faithfulness contribute to the dilemma? Or does it just add to it? If not, what do we do to find a pathway that avoids the elephant stampede that threatens to overtake us? And when you come to Psalm 50 and you read that, it reads as though a court hearing's taking place. God summons all the earth and God summons heaven, and they are to come and to be witnesses as God acts as judge before the people. And as God starts to sort of lay out the case, God says, "Look, I don't bring charges against you because of your burnt offerings. You're practicing the ritual." I mean, why wouldn't they? It's what's contained in the law. They're following the guide, they're following what has been given to them as instruction. You're following the routine, you're upholding tradition, but the fact of the matter is, I don't need your bulls. The cattle on 1,000 hills are mine. If I were hungry, I would just eat. I wouldn't bother you with it. And so if the usual path, the one that's tried and true, even the one that seems to be upheld by law and tradition, isn't accomplishing the worshiper's objective, then what do? They need to find a different way. Now, there are several types of offering in the Old Testament. And in this psalm, when God says, "I don't want your offering," the word is ola. "I don't want your ola offering," which was the whole burnt offering. Take your best animal in, you burn the whole thing. The priest doesn't get any. The family doesn't get any. No one takes any food, any sustenance, any nourishment away from that. The entire thing is burned under the assumption that that's what God wants and that the smoke somehow is pleasing to God. And God says in this psalm, "That's not the offering I want. What I want is your thank offering." Now, the thank offering, the todah, is unleavened cakes. I mean, just from a cost perspective, it's not as demanding on the worshiper, is it? Bring your best bull, make me a few griddle cakes. I mean, there's a big difference. So God doesn't eliminate the ritual. God doesn't say, "I don't want you in worship. I don't want you expressing your gratitude." But God does say, "The way you're doing it, really is wasting a lot. The way you're doing it is not the way I desire it to be. Here's what I want, God says. Be thankful. Fulfill your vows, which we could say, be faithful. Be thankful, be faithful, and call on me in your day of trouble. And by the way, those of you wicked, and I might just say, those of you, those pretenders, those who sort of claim they're living up to the faith, to those pretenders who go through the motions without the transformation of the heart, without the transformation of practice, the concern George Fox had about Christianity when Friends began, to you pretenders who don't keep your vows, your covenant, your commitment to faithfulness, stop it. If you're not going to stop it, at least stop pretending like you're living a faithful life. And then goes on to give a short list of examples where, given the option to do the right thing, folks make the other choice. So they confuse participation of the ritual as the sum total of the faith experience, and they leave aside actions that demonstrate faith and justice and other things that are of concern. So can you imagine, 2018, you come to worship one day and you hear the Creator say something like, well, you've been following your guide, you've been doing what we've told you, but the truth is, I don't need your silent worship. I don't need to hear those two or three hymns. I want you to find a different way to express worship. Or here's what I want. You've been doing what's been asked of you, but that road won't really lead you home. I mean, don't you love it when you encounter a detour? And the way you thought you knew, you can't take anymore. It's sort of true of any route I take in Wayne County right now. Got to go somewhere else. The routes changed, the rules are changed, or what you thought was trustworthy, what you thought was certain, no longer appears to be so certain. Not long after I retired from ESR, and I've tried to say to people all along the way when they've said, are you really retiring? And I say, you know, it could be retirement, it could be transition, I don't know. What I know is this work is done. But not long after I retired, and people seem to have a hard time understanding or believing that, so I received this call from an acquaintance in North Carolina, and he says, he was really anxious that I should find my next thing to do. I had to have that figured out and done. He says, so what is it you want to do? You have this chance to do something new. Do you want to teach? Do you want to go back into the pastorate? Do you want to develop a consulting business? I mean, you can do something new altogether. What do you want to do? And I was finding this whole conversation really frustrating because it was clear he was ignoring the fact that I felt at this time the most important thing was that I stop and I wait and I listen and I see what doors open and if, in fact, it seems God calls me through any of them. And when I wouldn't give him an answer, he persisted one last time with sort of one last shove, and he says with his own exasperation, well, what is it that you want to be? And without thinking and without hesitation, I said, Frank, I just want to be faithful. That's it. That's all of it. Nothing more, nothing less. And thankfully, that ended the conversation. And I mean, I was sort of surprised to hear that. I was happy to hear that come out of my mouth, but I hadn't really thought about it and put it in those terms. This psalm is about faithfulness. It raises the same question that Micah raises in a more direct fashion when he says, what does the Lord God require of you? Each generation, each individual interested in the religious or the spiritual component of their life has to entertain that question, and usually not just once, but over and over and over. And a meeting like this one needs to periodically revisit that question. When we travel, tours often include cathedrals and mosques and temples. I think it's because they're usually free, so the tour company can drop you off there and it doesn't cost them anymore. That's what I think. But what do I know? But on our way back from India, we had a stop in the United Arab Emirates, and we were there for 3 nights. And on one day in Abu Dhabi, we went to a mosque that will just leave you speechless. It is gorgeous. And when we asked about it, if I remember correctly, one, it was relatively new, that I'm certain. And if I remember correctly, the guide told us the mosque cost over $1 billion to build, and it was funded by a single individual who was expressing his thankfulness to God for his success in business. And that's not a typically or specifically Muslim response to success. In Myanmar, on an earlier trip, we went to this city that had, at one time, they told us over 3,000 temples in that city. And I said, where did all these temples come from? Can't these people get along? Why do you need that many in a city this size? And they said, oh, no, that's not how it works. Each temple has been built by a family who, I mean, some are grand and some are small, but they built it as a sign of their thanksgiving. And whenever they have their festivals or their celebrations, the family loads up the pickup truck or the van or whatever, and they drive in from the country, and it's their temple they go to. And so, it's, you know, it's not just the Muslims. It's there with those temples in Myanmar. And when you visit Europe and you see some of those great old cathedrals, some of them are sponsored by, you know, the state, and some are sponsored by individuals, but you get that same thing. This desire to have this elaborate, ornate structure with flying buttresses and these beautiful stained glass windows and incredible craftsmanship. And some of them take a lifetime to build. You know, the person who designed it doesn't live long enough to see the completion. And in moments like those, when I see them, I find myself feeling awe and wonder, and yet there's this question, and I wonder, in response to what does the Lord require, why is it we so frequently believe the answer to that question involves building these monstrous facilities that cost so much in time and labor, etc.? What is it in the human experience that makes us think that's what God requires of us, an extravagant complex? I don't deny their beauty, but I hear Psalm 50 echoing in the background. I don't need your bull. I don't need your massive expenditures. I don't need these ornate houses necessarily. Show me your thankfulness. Show me your faithfulness. Remember to trust me in your most trying times. I think whenever we face the question of what constitutes faithfulness, part of the answer hinges on how we define it. There's a lot of flexibility in the how of thanking and the how of keeping the covenant and how of trusting, depending on how you define the word to begin with. Is faithfulness merely a participation in a set of rituals? Some models of the church would suggest that is, in fact, how one becomes faithful. And that could be the downfall of the audience in the psalm. Rituals can be meaningful, but should they be the sum total of our faith? Is it intellectual and emotional, where we assent to a certain set of beliefs? These are the things we hold in common. These are the things we believe are true. They unite us. They define us. If those transform our values and affect our decisions and actions, that will be significant. But if they're more like a little memorized list that we can pull out and recite, while over here our life reflects none of these, then I think we'll find our faith is lacking. A book Judy and I are reading right now called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century suggests that in our day, groups may be more galvanized by the things we oppose than the things we support. And I find myself wondering, would we choose a meeting based on what we were against? Or would we choose one based on what we believed, what we had in common? I wonder how the faithful should weigh in on these divisive topics these days, especially. It seems to be galvanizing us into some odd assortments of groups. Or in addition to intellectual assent or ritual, faithfulness might be defined as or be rooted in choice and expression. That's to say, activity. So one of the things I like about that chapter in Hebrews 11, where it lists the heroes of faith, the faith was evident in the choices made. Abram and Sarah left the homeland in search of a place they trusted they'd find one day, but were not certain. Rahab, the prostitute, harbored fugitives as an expression of her thankfulness and of her understanding of the covenant. So faith sometimes leads us to actions. Ritual, assent, and action. I think it's not either or. I think it's a blend of all three. The dicey part is, in my opinion, even when we think we have it figured out, even when we think we know the path, even when we think we can visit the elephants and stay safely away and there'll be no trouble, we may not know for certain. Surprises happen. Life takes funny turns. And there's this wonderfully troubling statement in Exodus where Moses is anxiously trying to talk God out of sending him to liberate the Egyptians. And you remember, Moses had all sorts of reasons why he shouldn't go. And he says, you know, why would the Israelites trust me? And who shall I say sent me? And why would they follow me? And God says, I'll be with you. And this will be the sign that it is I who have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt back to this holy mountain, then you will know that I am with you. And that basically means when you're done, that's when you'll know. It's not until you get back to where I told you you were going that you'll know it was I who was leading you there. So we wind up without having this blessed assurance all the time. So God gives us God's assurance, but we will not experientially know for certain until it's over and we've arrived at our intended destination. So it's about keeping faith in the one who called us, even when the way's uncertain. I think there's a lot about life that fits that description. When the elephants run towards you rather than with you, you may need to try a new direction. You won't have time to sit and call, wait for the sense of the meeting. You just have to go. Sometimes we don't have the benefit of charging elephants to alert us we need to change. But sometimes we need a little change, of course. Judy's dad has a family gathering down on his farm on Labor Day. Most years we don't get to go, but this year we did. And during the course of that day, I was just sitting around, because that's what you do there. You sit around, you talk to family you haven't seen in a while, and meet family you've never met. And I'm sitting there watching, and I saw one of the cousins leave his car and start walking over in this direction. And as he starts to walk this way, someone else in the family yelled out, "Hey, Johnny, what are you doing?" And Johnny answered, "Walking this way." And I don't know if that was a smart aleck response or if that was an honest response, but it's occurred to me that for those of us who desire to be faithful, sometimes that's the best answer we've got. When people ask, "What are you doing to be faithful?" We're walking this way. And we'll walk this way until it's clear to us that the path has to change. Running with elephants, running from elephants. Sometimes that's just what you got to do.